are its authors and enablers. The natural result of our collective decision-making over the past decades is an economy in which a small number of people hit the jackpot each year. I'm not talking about the local dentist, lawyer, or doctor, the kind of rich folks I grew up around in North Carolina. I am talking about the families in households of the top 1% by income or wealth. Families that have more than $10 million in assets. By contrast, the average doctor in my hometown last year made $189,000. And like most wealthy Americans, was assuredly not part of the 1%. The people I'm talking about are people like me and my neighbors in Manhattan. They are CEOs at S&P 500 companies who, on average, are paid 347 times more than the typical worker at their company, a remarkable increase from the historical average of 20 to 60 times. They are superstar athletes, real estate agents and developers, and blockbuster lawyers, the most elite in each of their fields. They are also overwhelmingly not diverse. 96% of the ultra-wealthy, 1%, are white. The result is an unprecedented collection of wealth controlled by a small number of families. A single family, the Waltons, all of whom inherited their wealth from the Walmart empire, now controls as much wealth as the bottom 43% of the country combined. 137 million Americans. Just the top 0.1% of our population, the 160,000 families who have $20 million or more, control the same amount as the entire bottom 90% of Americans combined. The chasm between the rich and the poor has not been so wide since 1929, the year of the biggest collapse in Wall Street's history. The problem isn't that our new economy has fueled the rise of Facebook and mega winners. It's that the growth of the ultra wealthy has come at the expense of everyday Americans. Rapid technological advances, globalization, and financialization are pulling the rug out from under the middle class and lower income Americans. The same forces that enabled the rise of Facebook, Google, and Amazon have undermined the stability and economic opportunity that most Americans have a right to expect. Of all of the effects that these economic forces have unleashed, the most pronounced is the destruction of full-time jobs and the rise of contract labor, often symbolized by the Uber drivers of the gig economy. Ironically, technology has taken us backward and made jobs look more like what they were for most of our country's history, poorly paid and precarious. We tend to think that the gig economy is a new phenomenon, but the mid-20th century was a brief interlude in a long history in which jobs were more often than not unreliable. Before the second half of the 20th century, work was more likely to be at home, on the farm, or in a short-term stint somewhere, in the kinds of jobs my grandfather had as a young man. He grew up in a small house that sat on a few acres of rocky land in northwestern North Carolina, a mile from the Virginia border. The sixth of seven children, he quit school when he was 15 to help his family grow vegetables, raise chickens, milk cows, and generally keep the family farm in order. His first experience of a job was close to home, seasonally dependent, and tied to the completion of small, discrete tasks. His parents paid him with food and shelter. With historically bad timing, his parents decided to uproot the whole Hughes clan, including my grandfather's new wife, Thelma, and move to Philadelphia to take advantage of the economic boom of the roaring 1920s. They arrived in 1929, just in time for the stock market's collapse. For the next 2 years, My grandparents lived alongside 11 other people in a standalone house in Philadelphia's Frankford neighborhood. Lacking any education or non-farm skills, my grandfather decided that he would become a barber. In my imagination, I see a southern kid roaming about a dense Philadelphia neighborhood, waiting for a client in need, like a Lyft or Uber driver of today, except with a pair of scissors in hand. My grandfather had cut hair. He had those shears to prove it. But he had never really been a barber like the barbers I would later see as an adult. The bowl cuts he gave me as a kid confirmed that he had failed to develop any meaningful skill. Crammed in like sardines with his family in a new city, he learned to make do because anything that contributed to the family's income, even a few dollars, helped. It wasn't just my grandfather whose life reflected the precarious nature of work at the time. In the 1930 census, only 3 out of the 9 working-age people in my grandparents' crowded Philadelphia household had ever earned a steady income from a full-time job. My grandfather's brother-in-law had been a molder in the furniture industry, his brother had been a hide sorter in a tannery, and his sister was a stenographer in an insurance company. But everyone else picked up whatever gig they could find. But then my grandfather's economic prospects brightened, mirroring what happened to many in the rest of the country. He landed the job of country club manager and groundskeeper back home in North Carolina, which required a lot more than 40 hours a week of work, but provided housing and relative stability. He was paid $30 a month, the equivalent of $430 today, plus free board. My grandmother came as part of the package deal, and became the sole person staffing the pro shop and food stand. These jobs brought them much-needed independence from their extended families and some stability, but it was still far from a living wage for a young family of 3. The economic growth that lifted many Americans up over the following decades did the same for my family. When my grandfather served in the Second World War, my grandmother worked in a local diner as many hours a week as she could get. After the war, she found stable employment as a worker in a hosiery mill and worked the next 30 years as a manager overseeing the looms that made socks and hose. In the 1950s, my grandfather became a medium-haul truck driver for an oil company, and while his schedule remained irregular, his paycheck arrived every 2 weeks, a heartbeat of stability in the background of their lives. My parents got their first jobs in the 1950s and 1960s. They not only enjoyed the security of regular paychecks, but also had the added benefits of employer-provided health insurance, paid sick days, vacation time, and pensions. For the 3 decades spanning 1950 to 1980, most Americans, particularly white men, were able to find steady work in jobs that provided the foundation for a stable middle-class life. Companies provided a suite of wraparound services that guaranteed stability in their employees' lives. In 1955, a big corporation like Kodak spent $1,000 per year, roughly $8,000 today, on life insurance, retirement, sick pay, disability benefits, and vacation pay for each employee. Employees with 15 years of service or more received medical care for life, not just for themselves, but also for their dependents. This period of stable jobs and nearly full employment was a brief historical exception, but it has been burnished in our collective psyches as a golden age. The short period came to an end as globalization, rapid technological advancements, and the rise of finance modified the nature of jobs so that they became more precarious and piecemeal. If my parents were 10 years younger, my father likely would have lost his paper-selling job and been out of work, thanks to the collapse of small-town printers in the digital transition and the rapid consolidation in the industry powered by finance. He would almost certainly now be looking for a new career or some task to get paid for, very late in life. My mother would be making less money than she did decades earlier, because wages for teachers in North Carolina have not kept up with inflation, let alone today's higher cost of living. They, like most Americans, especially those working for private sector businesses, would be falling behind at a moment in their lives when they need security more than ever. For workers, the American corporation used to act as a shock absorber. Now, it's a roller coaster, the journalist Rick Wortsman writes. When unemployed people in urban areas find themselves without jobs or marketable skills today, they do what my grandfather did. Instead of reaching for a pair of barber shears, they reach for their smartphones and register to become Lyft drivers and Postmates delivery people. TaskRabbiters pitch in to assemble furniture, rake leaves, or even stand in line to buy theater tickets or a newly released iPhone. In some cases, these contract jobs are a godsend because they help workers who only get part-time hours elsewhere to supplement their income, as laborers have done since the beginning of time. We often think of millennials in these jobs, the masters of the art of the side hustle, but the numbers show it isn't just millennials doing contingent work. A quarter of the working-age population in the United States and Europe engage in some type of independently paid gig, some by choice, but many out of necessity. People who find work through apps like Lyft and TaskRabbit get a lot of attention, but they are the tip of the iceberg. The instability that characterizes their work has spread throughout the economy as the class of low-quality jobs has grown. If you include not only independent gigs, but part-time workers, temps, and on-call workers, the number of people working in contingent jobs balloons to over 40% of all American workers. The blue-collar jobs of yesteryear that paid decent salaries and provided benefits have declined from about half of overall jobs 60 years ago to around 20% today. A Princeton study found that of all the jobs created between 2005 and 2015, 94% of them were contract or temporary, meaning virtually every job we created in the last decade was piecemeal and the income was unreliable. Many of these jobs of the new economy pay poorly, require flexible schedules, and do not offer the stability of benefits or guaranteed pay. People in these jobs are Starbucks and Walmart employees who barely get 20 hours of work a week, babysitters and dog walkers, consultants and delivery people. Some of these workers may get to choose when they work, but they are more often beholden to when the market is ready to employ their services. Some days they may have a boatload of customers, and others, none. Even when they do have a lot of customers, Uber drivers make barely $15 an hour before accounting for expenses like gas, maintenance, or depreciation of their cars. Contract and part-time workers may be able to make some money, but they don't have any of the stability or the opportunity to get ahead that a traditional job brought in the middle of the 20th century. As contract work has expanded, wages for traditional full-time jobs have stagnated. In May 2017, I stood on the front porch of a home in Warren, Ohio, and chatted through a screen door with a woman I'll call Julie, while her daughter watched television behind her. I had come to Northeast Ohio at the invitation of the Ohio Organizing Collaborative, a coalition of community organizations, faith institutions, labor unions, and policy groups, to talk with people affected by the forces that gave rise to Facebook. Julie lived in a white, traditionally Democratic neighborhood that had voted for Donald Trump. Across from her house was a deserted, half-demolished parking lot, and behind it loomed an abandoned factory. Julie seemed calm and resilient, but she was visibly exhausted. She had a job as an office manager at the local school, and her husband worked nights in a pipe factory. All around them, property values were in a free fall, and there was little hope on the horizon. "We're treading water just to stay alive," she said. Julie and her husband had reliable work and a home, and they almost certainly were not captured in poverty statistics. But the despondency Julia exuded, and the lack of hope she seemed to have for her family, haunted me. The question, "Do you think the country is moving in the right direction?" seemed almost comically irrelevant when I asked it to open the conversation. The country had left her behind. Even if it was moving in the right direction, that wasn't going to help her. In many cases, automation and globalization have eliminated jobs in certain industries altogether. As I continued down Julie's street, I struck up conversations with anyone I could find. It helped that I was paired up with a young man from the host nonprofit who lived nearby. In the span of a single hour's walk on a block in America's heartland, the effects of today's economic forces were on full display. Three doors down from Julie, we talked to a union pipe layer who had been automated out of his last job and was trying to get retrained. A few houses further, a woman in her 50s had just been forced to retire early from the local department store, a victim of low consumer spending and ruthless price gouging by the Walmart down the street. None of these people were poor, but all of their wages had stagnated or decreased in recent years. Many of the houses around them had been abandoned or were in a state of near total disrepair, evidence of a worse fate than wage stagnation. Automation has destroyed jobs across America, particularly in communities like Warren. The jobs that disappeared first were the ones that required manual routine labor, like an automobile manufacturing, historically one of the largest employers in the area. The world's largest automobile manufacturer, General Motors, made twice as many cars in 2011 as it made 55 years earlier, with a third of the workforce. A single worker in 1955 made 8 cars. In 2011, 43. To be sure, at the same time as technological advancements have destroyed jobs, they have created others, like Lyft drivers and Walmart workers. But the new jobs often require different skills, are unreliable, and pay worse. Walmart employees working less than 30 hours a week have no benefits, insurance, vacation, or paid leave. And what's more, they're lucky to make $15 an hour. That's a far cry from a factory worker who, at least in one region of Ohio, used to make $40 an hour or more, including the value of benefits. Automation may not have reduced the overall number of jobs, but the new jobs it has created are lower quality than the ones it has erased. Meanwhile, globalization has similarly allowed enormous industries to move overseas. The economy in my hometown of Hickory has been decimated since furniture manufacturers moved production to China and the telecom industry downsized. These industries were the two major sources of employment when I was a kid, and they no longer exist. At the same time as robots made car assembly lines more efficient, trade agreements made it easier for the assembly of cars to move overseas. Meanwhile, private equity firms, cousin of venture capital, bought up entire industries and squeezed short-term financial rewards out of them, caring little for companies' long-term performance. All of these changes have introduced a profound confusion into the American psyche about the state of the American dream. We live in an age of overnight billionaires, where anything seems possible. But economic opportunity is fading in many of our communities. There's a hope that the immense wealth created for the mega winners might find its way to our children. But at the same time, a deep anger is simmering, a result of the growing sense that diligent, hard work is not necessarily creating all this wealth. We may not have realized we were creating this world over the past few decades, but we did. Our actions now can perpetuate it, or we can embrace more powerful instruments to combat the inequality we've produced. Kenya and back. As a kid, I watched my parents dutifully tithe each year. They would tabulate their expected after-tax income and make a plan to give away 10%. Most of this money went to our church, but they set some aside to support local nonprofits and charities. They were exacting in how much they gave away, and insisted that I follow their model with my $5 weekly allowance. I can remember my father regularly writing a check and stuffing it in a church envelope each week. As soon as I was old enough, I stuffed a few dollars into those envelopes once a month myself. I took this tradition into adulthood and tithed a few thousand dollars every year out of my salaries from Facebook and the Obama campaign. And then, in the late summer of 2008, I sold $1 million of Facebook stock on the private markets. According to the math, I would need to give away $100,000 that year. I quickly realized I had no idea where I could put that kind of money with any confidence that it would make a lasting impact. A few years later, the challenge of effectively investing in the right causes became more complicated when, after Facebook's IPO, my husband and I decided to go beyond tithing and give away the vast majority of our newfound wealth over the course of our lifetimes. It had been one thing to invest modest amounts in inspiring organizations working on important causes. It was self-evident, for instance, that we would become donors to the Movement for Marriage Equality, which my husband worked on full-time. But as we considered other causes to support, we found that we needed to make a distinction between those that seemed worthwhile, and there were many, and the ones that were the most critical to us in particular. As we added zeros to the amounts we were giving, choosing the right organizations and leaders became much more complex, charged, and important to get right. These investments could radically reshape organizations' trajectories and change people's lives. We wanted to make them carefully and thoughtfully. And we wanted to get the most bang for the buck, to do the most effective good with each additional dollar of investment. One of the causes I decided to focus on was the fight to end extreme poverty internationally. What follows is the story of the journey I went on to explore the most effective ways to be helpful, and the surprising implications that work had for the economic challenges we face here at home. It is the story of how I came to believe in the power of cash transfers in general, and the guaranteed income in particular, to empower people to chase their dreams. It was approaching noon, and I was nauseous, hot, and restless. And I was sitting in the back of a white Land Rover, bouncing along a dirt road in northeast Kenya, somewhere near the Somali border. Our caravan of a half dozen vehicles had set out from Nairobi before dawn, bound for a desert village called Durtu. A year before, I had read a new book advancing a theory of how to help the billions of people who live on less than a dollar a day. Written by the economist and development expert Jeffrey Sachs, The End of Poverty was a blockbuster success. In it, he argued that if wealthy countries banded together to commit a small percentage of their economic output to anti-poverty work, the global community could end extreme poverty once and for all. He made the case that if we invest just enough money in a suite of social services like water purification, primary schooling, agricultural training, and rural electrification, economic development would follow. He dubbed the theory integrated service delivery. Working in conjunction with the United Nations, his nonprofit had chosen 12 sites in Africa called Millennium Villages to test the idea. The nomadic encampment at Durtu was one of these villages, in theory, a showpiece for what could happen if countries got serious about ending poverty. Sachs himself was in the Land Rover just ahead of ours, accompanied by several members of his team. After driving for 5 hours, the caravan came to a stop amid a cloud of dust. In front of us was a collection of 10-roofed buildings, with plain brown cement walls that looked like they had grown up out of the desert along with the scrub surrounding them. The largest was long and narrow, like a barracks, and in front of the building was an open dirt field. A blue tarp had been set up off to the side as a kind of makeshift tent. As I climbed out of the vehicle, relieved to have 2 feet on the ground, a half dozen Kenyans emerged from the shade of the blue tent and moved toward us. The women wore headscarves, and the men, standard Western clothing. Durtu is in Kenya's northeastern province, which is effectively a slice of Somalia governed by Kenya. The border between the two countries is only 80 miles away, and like many of Africa's borders, it was drawn in the midst of the First World War with little consideration for the lives and cultures of the people on either side. The arbitrariness of the border was only outdone by the randomness of Dertu's founding. In 1997, UNICEF drilled a well in the middle of an arid stretch of desert for nomadic tribes to use, and Dertu had grown up around it. Dertu's residents were the poorest people in one of the poorest regions of East Africa, and because of their nomadic lifestyle, some of the hardest to help. Sacks and the Millennium Village team had purposefully chosen to work there because of the challenge it represented. What we're talking about here is a community that is barely surviving, Sacks told the journalist Nina Monk, who wrote a book on his work in the Millennium Villages in 2013. Violent poverty, natural hazards, conflict, degradation of the environment, objectively speaking, it doesn't get harder than this, he said. The leader of the village, Ahmed Mohammed, walked over to greet us. A tall man with a short beard, he wore a traditional skull cap on his head. Several other village staff, looking joyous and relieved to see us, followed closely behind him. After a brief exchange of courtesies, they led us back to the tarp. As we sat cross-legged on traditional blankets, Ahmed and his team served us a lunch of fresh goat meat from a slaughter earlier in the day in honor of our arrival. They were especially deferential and courteous to Professor Sacks, whom they treated more like royalty than the academic economist I knew him to be. They clearly recognized that he had the power to change their lives. By the time we finished our meal, word had spread that the Mzungu, the white people, had arrived. Several dozen nomads surrounded us, smiling brightly. Only a few of them spoke English, but all of them wanted to catch a glimpse of Professor Sacks. We began our tour of the village just as the midday sun peaked in the sky and the temperature was pushing 100. Standing outside a small building that housed a new health clinic, we heard about the number of childbirths that were happening indoors instead of in the bush. We peered through the window at a sparse but organized dispensary equipped with all the basics, sanitary gloves, syringes, an eye chart. Nothing was out of place. All appeared freshly cleaned and orderly. From there, we moved to the dormitories, where the kids slept during the school year. Ahmed had convinced UNICEF to construct the simple buildings by making the case that having a place for children to sleep would encourage the nomadic herders to allow their young kids to stay in Dertu for school. That barracks-like building, which had been completed just the year before, was the boys' dormitory. My stomach was roiling from the car ride, or the goat, or some combination of the two. Desperate for relief from the sun, I peeled off from the group and walked inside, where it was much cooler. I could still hear Ahmed, and no one seemed to notice my absence. Curious to look around, I began to wander a bit on my own. Something felt off. The clinic we had just seen had seemed a little too perfect, and this room felt a little too clean. I walked down a long aisle of bunk beds, each with a folded blanket atop it, one after another, perfectly ordered. I looked for any sign that people were actually sleeping here, for any trace of the dozens of young boys who, in theory, lived here year-round. Where were the personal items that school kids have, even the poorest of the poor? There were no pencils, no bars of soap, no papers, not even a scrap of clothing. There were no signs of life. It was more like a movie set than a kid's dorm. I went back outside and waited for Ahmed to finish speaking. The group peeked into the building through a window and started to move on. I approached Ahmed as we walked. "Where's the stuff?" I asked him quietly. He seemed not to understand. "Where's the kids' personal stuff? Pencils, books, that kind of thing. There's nothing in the dormitory." "We cleaned it before you came," he replied while nodding. I nodded back and kept walking. It was true. The room had looked recently swept and tidied. Maybe I was wrong, and I just didn't understand the real depth of poverty in Dertu. Next up was a small schoolhouse. We learned that the teacher had formerly traveled to nearby pastoralist encampments to teach, but since the dormitories had been built, it was possible for him to centralize his work in Dertu. The classroom was extremely sparse, but it was stocked with basic items, chalk, erasers, books, simple desks. But yet again, there was no sign of life or the presence of any actual children. The teacher stood at the front of the classroom, smiling and nodding, and told us about how flexible and modern the curriculum was. We walked down the hall and stopped beside a single computer sitting on a desk behind a grill and padlock protecting it. Professor Sachs turned to me to make sure I was paying attention to the tech part of the tour. Had this been prepped especially for me? The teacher told us how miraculous it was that Sony had donated several computers to the school. Ericsson had built a cell phone tower nearby, and thanks to those two gifts, the wealth and knowledge of the entire internet could be tapped by his students. I was intrigued. I asked, this time in front of the whole group, is it the teachers or the kids who use the computers? Both, but mostly the teachers, the teacher answered. What do you use it for? I asked him. Everything. We use it for everything, he replied. At first, I thought there might just be a breakdown in translation. If you weren't fluent in English, you might give such a broad and ambiguous answer to a hard question. But both Ahmed and the teacher spoke English well. I was becoming increasingly suspicious. This computer was literally locked up, even on the day of the tour. The internet connection, if it had one, would be a slow and unreliable one via the cell tower or satellite. Either way, it would make the internet extremely difficult to use. I love the idea of nomads in the Somali desert exploring the world through their Google searches, but it seemed nearly unbelievable that an internet built for the West would be of much day-to-day use to the people here, if it worked at all. What kind of things in particular do you do? I pressed the teacher. We use it for all kinds of things. Can you give me an example? He looked confused, so one of the White Millennium Village program staffers volunteered that they used it for things like lesson plan development. I was bordering on obnoxious, but I had come halfway across the world, so I persisted. What kind of sites or resources do you use for lesson plan development? I asked the teacher. A look of panic crossed his face. We can follow up with that kind of info afterward, the white staffer interjected once more. Others started to shift uncomfortably, but no one said anything. The tour continued. When the journalist Nina Monk later visited the village, she discovered that the computers had never been connected to the internet, and all of them were eventually stolen. The rest of the afternoon was full of similarly upbeat and evasive claims. Everything was going extremely well, but nothing seemed right. The Millennium Village felt more and more like a Potemkin village to me. Finally, after spending just 2 or 3 hours in Dirtu, we returned to Land Rovers and departed. I left with more questions and answers, and over the next couple of years, I got them. Almost from the beginning, the project had been beset by controversy. A series of papers published just after my visit in 2010 called into question the Millennium Village's marketing materials. Its annual reports claimed, quote-unquote, remarkable progress and cited lower incidences of HIV and malarial infections, lower child mortality rates, and more educational opportunities. But researchers at the Center for Global Development at the World Bank noted that it was impossible to measure the village's impact because there was no control or empirical baseline to compare it to. Malarial and HIV infection rates had been falling in neighboring villages too, and educational opportunities had been expanded in those places as well. Though Sachs disputed these claims, much of the development community grew skeptical of the project. The lead economist at the World Bank's development group called Sachs's assertions of the impact baffling. A year later, the director of monitoring and evaluation for the Millennium Villages was forced to resign after he was caught manipulating data to claim that the child mortality rate was decreasing 3 times faster in Millennium Villages than it was in Kenya as a whole. 5 years after the project began in Dirtu, despite millions of dollars of corporate and government philanthropy, Dirtu had no paved roads, electricity, or running water. Its latrines were full. Garbage was piled high. The members of the community filed a 14-point complaint with the local member of parliament. Sachs raised an additional $70 million to extend his project in some of the other villages, but the Millennium Villages website says that work in Dirtu was completed in 2011. And yet for all that, the project's 2010 annual report claimed a stunning transformation of 500,000 lives. The Millennium Villages had been one of the most expensive and troubled interventions in Africa. Yet the nonprofit behind the villages, Millennium Promise, has a 3-star rating out of 4 possible on Charity Navigator, a website that helps donors make informed decisions about which nonprofits to support. Over the past decade, Millennium Promise has raised nearly $200 million. Its branding book provides guidelines for how to present its logo, and its annual report and website show smiling faces, positive statistics, and specific results. It looks and feels like just about every other nonprofit brochure you've seen. Looking at it from the outside, you would have no idea how ineffective and discredited the model is. The failure of the Millennium Village project was not because Professor Sachs and the team didn't have the best of intentions. It's hard not to be humbled by their dedication to the cause. They are some of the most driven, caring, and generous people on the planet. But good intentions and the smartest of expert interventions alone are not enough to transform lives. The Millennium Villages came to represent for me an approach to combating economic injustice and poverty that was about engineering progress from the top down, rather than respecting the agency and autonomy of the people you set out to empower. In this approach, foreign experts assume that interventions as simple and superficially laudable as digging a well or building a school will improve the lives of the people they're meant to serve. But every culture and place presents unique and often hidden challenges, and a lot of money and energy can be wasted quickly. An expert's plan, hatched in Nairobi or New York, might sound good and look attractive to a donor in a colorful brochure, but that doesn't mean it will work or improve people's lives thousands of miles away. To be clear, some of the other Millennium Villages fared better than Dirtu. The second village in Kenya, called Sori, has produced more meaningful results, increased agricultural output, more children in school, and fewer people infected with malaria. Aid interventions can occasionally work. But the question is, at what cost? What else could we be funding with those dollars? If we could help and empower the poor more effectively and more cheaply, why wouldn't we? I began to wonder if a different kind of approach that embraces the decision-making power of the beneficiaries and invests in them directly might not only be more respectful of the community served, but more impactful too. As a person looking to invest every dollar as effectively as possible, this seemed to me to be the most important and urgent question to ask. In the year after that trip to Kenya, I began work on a nonprofit startup called Jumo. Our goal was to help nonprofits in the United States and around the globe publicize their work and connect with new donors and volunteers. We created a social network for causes, and 5,000 nonprofits signed up. As we built the network, I began to feel that we were playing the role of a marketing channel for the charities, which had nothing to do with how effective they might be. Unlike in the private sector, where a store owner knows she's doing well when a lot of people buy her goods, nonprofits don't have the same feedback loop. The number of donations that come in is not necessarily correlated with the quality of work the charity is doing, but instead is tied to how well the nonprofit leaders sell their causes. Marketing science manipulates well-intentioned potential donors by telling them that their gifts will be matched or by showing a heart-wrenching photo of a child with a fly on her nose. The charities are not doing anything wrong. Over time, they have developed a playbook to convert sympathy into contributions. Those donations pay their bills. But the natural result of this structure is that organizations put more and more emphasis on effective fundraising and less emphasis on assessing whether the programs they are administering are effective. Few nonprofit groups invest the time and resources to have independent third parties verify their impact. My lesson from the Millennium Villages in Durtu was to never assume that good intentions mean real impact, even if the people at work are sincere and knowledgeable. Without realizing it at first, I had created in Jumo yet another marketing channel for charities to sell themselves, when what I should have been doing was finding a better way to assess their effectiveness. I quickly became disillusioned and decided to merge Jumo into another online network. I began to focus more narrowly on the question of how I could invest the wealth that was still building from Facebook into a cause that I could be sure would have an impact. I was on the hunt for something verifiably helpful, something that didn't just make for good marketing. Late one evening, I discovered several blog posts on the website of a group called GiveWell that one of its founders had written during a trip to India. I knew the author, Holden Karnofsky, because he and his colleague, Eli Hassenfeld, had sublet a few desks in our shared office space a year earlier. Before starting GiveWell, Eli and Holden had been associates at Bridgewater, one of the largest hedge funds in the world. Their challenge was similar to mine. They wanted to use the same rigorous methods they had used to evaluate a financial opportunity for their hedge fund to assess the charities they were considering donating to. We scoured the internet, but couldn't find the answers to our questions, either through charities' own websites or through the foundations that fund them, they wrote when they started GiveWell. They made it their mission to do research and due diligence for themselves and other donors on how to make their giving as impactful as it could possibly be. One of the blog posts I read that night offered a short and pithy reflection on the age-old question that many of us have struggled with at some point. Should I give money to a person begging in the street? Holden had gone to India and, in the face of rampant poverty and homelessness, found himself wondering if he should just pass out money. On my first trip to India years before, dozens of children, no more than 5 or 6 years old, had encircled me, tapping my legs and hands. Their plaintive, unwashed faces and persistent requests for chapati, 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 the word for a simple bread, had never left me. Here, more than in NYC, Holden wrote, I could arguably carry out a mini cash transfer program on my own. The question is whether I should. His provocation stuck in my head. Holden's question of whether he could run his own cash transfer program, shorthand for just giving people cash directly, wasn't just a passing curiosity. The GiveWell team and he felt a responsibility to investigate what it would mean to do exactly that, just as they ran down every single other way of giving to assess its impact. As GiveWell grew, it became an anchor for the effective altruism movement, a philanthropic approach moving away from pull-the-heartstrings inspiration and toward empirical, transparent, and rigorous evaluation of impact. The Princeton philosopher Peter Singer pioneered this utilitarian approach to philanthropy, and not without controversy. By donating a relatively small amount of money, you could save a child's life, he writes in The Life You Can Save. Maybe it takes more than the amount you needed to buy a pair of shoes, but we all spend money on things we don't really need, whether on drinks, meals out, clothing, movies, concerts, vacations, new cars, or house renovation. Is it possible that by choosing to spend your money on such things, rather than contributing to an aid agency, you're leaving a child to die? A child you could have saved? He wrote. Singer, GiveWell, and the effective altruism movement are in pursuit of a practical ethics that seeks not just to give away money, but to rethink our collective responsibility to one another and create a tradition in philanthropy focused on maximizing the return of each dollar invested. Holden's post only came to tentative initial conclusions, but I marveled at the simplicity of the idea of giving cash directly. My curiosity grew over the course of weeks and then months. Why was my default to trust an educated outsider or nonprofit executive with resources, rather than the poor themselves? The radical, irreverent nature of the idea that the poor might know the best way to solve their own problems hit a nerve. It connected to my natural skepticism of people in power that my parents had inculcated in me from a young age, and which had only grown with exposure to the professional nonprofit infrastructure I had witnessed in places like Dirtu. What if the most effective way to help somebody might be to get all those experts intent on over-engineering progress out of the way? A couple years later, I found myself back in Kenya for another pre-dawn trip into the bush. The day before, I had flown from New York to London, from London to Nairobi, and from Nairobi to the city of Kisumu. Despite being only 7 miles from the equator, the mountain air that morning was crisp and cool. This time, there was no caravan outside the hotel, just a single white van. I jumped in and joined the half dozen other passengers who worked for a nonprofit called GiveDirectly. I sat in the first row, and GiveDirectly's CEO, Michael Fay, a brown-haired, wiry man in his 30s, sat beside me. We set out on a 2-hour ride to a group of villages near a town called Saeya. An hour into the trip, the van popped a tire. We pulled over to the side of the road and filed out one by one. We all milled about awkwardly while the driver hauled out a spare and the equipment to change the tire. The swap did not look like it was going to happen quickly. Michael, uninterested in wasting time on such an important day, took a few steps away in frustration. Shuffling about, he turned around and looked at the group. "Should we just rent motorbikes for the last 20 miles?" he asked. "We'd probably get there faster anyway, and we could see more." I assumed he was joking, but all of a sudden the local staff were saying, "Let's do it!" I looked at a colleague who had accompanied me across the world. Her look back at me confirmed that they were indeed crazy. "How about we give it 15 minutes instead?" I said. We bought a Fanta from a shack nearby and settled in. This was my third trip to Kenya and my second to the GiveDirectly villages. My first had happened a year earlier. After I read Holden's blog post, my curiosity about cash transfers had grown quickly. Over the next several months, I had followed every lead I could find into the world of cash assistance. It turned out there was an entire field dedicated to the topic, and several books and hundreds of reports had been written about experimental cash transfer programs all over the world. Michael and another economist, Paul Niehaus, had recently started GiveDirectly to enable American donors to give cash away to those who needed it most. While working on their PhDs at Harvard, they had grown suspicious of the effectiveness of many aid programs. Hundreds of studies and their own instincts told them that cash might be a more powerful tool to help the poor than traditional programs. But no American charity would allow them to give directly to the people most in need. They decided to do it themselves. In 2010, they began distributing their own money to families, $1,000 to each, with no strings attached, who lived in the slums around Nairobi on less than a dollar a day. They incorporated GiveDirectly as a charity the same year and began raising money from outside donors as well. I connected with Michael and Paul soon after through what was then GiveDirectly's extremely basic website. Paul, an award-winning economist, moonlighted as a coder and had built the website himself. Light on photos, heavy on statistics, and generally clunky, it was the exact opposite of every nonprofit website I had seen over the previous few years, and I loved it. Clearly, they were uninterested in marketing, and they had no plan for donor cultivation or management. They scoffed at the idea of a gala or a glossy annual report and questioned everything about the traditional nonprofit model. They purposefully made themselves unappealing to the vast majority of donors so they could focus on a smaller set that valued performance over pop. Within months, I gave my first $100,000, and GiveDirectly in turn sent $90,000 of that via text message to 90 families who had been living on less than a dollar a day. They limit staff costs and overhead to 10% of each dollar given. This was as close to literally handing out money as I could come. An hour after the van had gotten underway again, it pulled over to the side of the road. There were no huts in sight and no evidence of human civilization outside of a few Kenyan women carrying parcels and walking alongside the road. The local staff member who had organized the expedition hopped out of the van, gestured toward the horizon, and said, "This way!" She set out, and the rest of us fell in line behind her. After a 20-minute walk through the bush, brambles nipping at our legs, we finally arrived at a set of red earth huts. All of the people who lived in this tiny village had received cash transfers over the past year, two payments of roughly $500 each, made via M-Pesa, a mobile service that enables easy money transfers. The digital money can be converted to traditional paper currency at any time. The villages that GiveDirectly serves are not directly connected to paved roads, and most do not have basic infrastructure like electricity or running water. Most of the villagers are engaged in subsistence farming and fishing. When GiveDirectly takes donors or journalists on tours of these villages, they don't pre-screen recipients to prepare and package the best stories, but instead choose the huts at random. You don't always meet the most talkative people or hear the most riveting stories, and a lot of times no one is home. But instead of marketing pizzazz, you see a more representative sample of the beneficiaries, and you know that you are not just being sold a bill of goods. We split up into two groups so as not to overwhelm the recipients. My group ducked into a hut with a new aluminum roof. Most of the huts we had seen on the walkover were thatched. The woman who sat across from us was nearly 6 feet tall and wore a simple cotton dress, yellow plastic sandals, and had a scarf tied on top of her head. She was very quiet, almost whispering her responses to our questions. She had lived in the hut for a decade, she told us, and her husband spent much of his time fishing on Lake Victoria. Her children were grown. They had used half of their transfer to replace a thatch roof with aluminum. The average amount saved in ongoing repair costs was $110 annually, meaning their reinvestment would pay off in a few years. She'd used the rest of the transfer for food and as a gift to her kids. We had similar conversations in the next two homes we visited. Another family had installed a solar-powered light bulb in their hut so their kids could do schoolwork in the evenings. One recipient said to us through the translator that another charity had given him a cow. "What am I going to do with a cow?" he said. "Now I have to feed it and take care of it." He didn't need or want livestock, but a charity had decided that he should have it, regardless of his interest or ability to maintain it. All of the homes had different color chalk markings on the doors, evidence of all of the other nonprofits who had come through at one point or another with some kind of service to provide or good to give out. Where were they now? Another recipient our companions talked to that day, a young bachelor, was the entrepreneurial type. Saturday nights in Kenya, like Saturday nights in a lot of other places in the world, are a time to rest and unwind after a busy week. Friends of his threw parties or celebrations with sodas, sweets, and beer. They used a small radio to play music, but the sound was often scrambled with static. He believed he could do better, so he used his first transfer to buy a keyboard. It enabled him to perform as a musician and DJ, and he charged the partygoers a small fee. With the second transfer, he invested in an unrelated and similarly creative idea. He spent some of the money on livestock and used the rest to buy a beehive. Everybody wanted fresh and cheap honey, and he didn't really mind the occasional bee sting. His apiary provided him another independent revenue stream. In contrast to the integrated service delivery model in the Millennium Villages, with its costly overhead and UN-approved white papers, GiveDirectly was doing something painfully simple and obvious. Letting the people in need decide for themselves. Village residents could pool their money to build a well, use the funds for school fees, or invest in their homes. Not every decision would be wise, but it seemed like this kind of investment respected their local knowledge and their ability to direct their own lives. And the evidence shows that on balance, cash transfers like these are more effective at improving the lives of the communities they serve than other aid interventions. In 2011, GiveDirectly's leadership enlisted independent researchers affiliated with MIT's Poverty Action Lab to assess the impact of their transfers. The analysis was done in coordination with the independent nonprofit Innovations for Poverty Action and the National Institutes of Health. The study analyzed the impact of cash transfers using a randomized control trial, the same methodology that pharmaceutical companies use to assess the power of a new drug and its side effects. The researchers surveyed recipients before they received the money to establish a baseline, and again afterward to understand the impact. They then compared those villages to a set of control villages that did not receive transfers. The design of the study was pre-announced, so it was impossible to bury unflattering data, and the researchers opened their raw datasets to the world. They even paid independent researchers to comb through it to find errors or inconsistencies. Even though the study had a relatively short time horizon of 2 years, the researchers documented significant positive effects on the cash recipients' assets, earnings, food security, mental health, and female empowerment. The income of families increased by 27%, and the value of the assets that they held, like livestock in their homes, increased by $430, a significant amount for people who live on less than a dollar a day. Additional spending on nutrition significantly reduced the family's food insecurity index, a measurement of meals skipped and diet quality. Perhaps most importantly, the recipients were happier. The researchers used a psychological well-being index that was a weighted average of the participants' responses to an internationally standardized questionnaire. They found a significant increase in self-reported life satisfaction. A reporter at Business Insider summarized the results. People who received the money were happier, more satisfied with life, less stressed, and depressed less often. The researchers also found that recipients of the benefit, along with their neighbors who did not receive the benefit but lived in the same village, scored higher on a female empowerment index that measures things like domestic violence rates and attitudes towards men. They're now doing a longer-term assessment to see if they can replicate the outcome, but these studies suggest that having more economic security lowers the overall stress level in a home and the rate of domestic violence. Interestingly, the study showed no increase in the amount of alcohol and tobacco consumed. Skeptical that participants would give an honest answer to the question, the researchers used a different methodology to assess the use of these so-called temptation goods. They presented a list of 5 common activities, like talking on the phone or visiting friends, and then asked how many of these activities the respondents had done in the past week. One group was presented with a list that did not include alcohol and tobacco, another with the list plus alcohol, and a third with the list plus tobacco. The question the respondents answered was, "Have you participated in any of these 5 activities in the past week?" And the respondents didn't need to specify which, if any, they had. The researchers compared the responses across different groups and found no increased likelihood that cash recipients consumed more alcohol or tobacco than the control group. GiveDirectly's study is a drop in the research bucket when it comes to cash. Over the past few decades, nearly 200 other studies have been conducted on 56 different kinds of cash transfer programs, and they've produced a variety of results based on the amount and frequency of the transfer, who receives it, and how long they receive it for. A recent review of all of these studies by the Overseas Development Institute found several consistent effects. Cash transfers reduce immediate poverty and increase savings, raise school attendance, cause recipients to use health services more frequently, and are associated with a reduction in child labor. Most studies show no effect on the amount of time adults work, and some show people work more. Another review of all cash studies by the World Bank showed no evidence that cash transfers affect drinking or smoking behavior. Aid or